Hi. As you all probably know by now, I am super excited about my new sponsor of this podcast, Lifeway Kefir. Lifeway Kefir makes delicious, cultured, low-fat milk smoothies that you can find in your local grocery store. Each bottle contains live and active probiotic cultures and is high in protein, calcium, and vitamin D. They're also gluten-free and 99% lactose-free. They're amazing. Visit lifewaykefir.com for more info and for coupons. Because who doesn't love coupons? That's lifewaykefir.com. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this bonus episode of the Court Junkie podcast. So obviously, I'm a court junkie, and chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, then you are too. In today's episode, I'm going to get a little personal and talk about the cases that affected me the most this year, whether I've covered them in my podcast or not. But first, I want to update all of you on my schedule for these next few holiday weeks. And I'm happy to let you know that I will be releasing a new episode each week as normally scheduled. Next week, I'll be doing an end-of-the-year update episode where I'll go over all of the cases that I've covered in this podcast and give you the latest scoops on them. Then the following week, I'll be releasing a court junkie brief that I am really excited about. It's about the shaken baby syndrome, and I did an interview that I think you're all going to love. And the week after that, I'll be releasing episode 12, and then so on and so forth. So I hope you all have a happy holiday and that I can help keep you entertained in between your returning of presents, eating delicious leftover food, and spending time with your loved ones. Now, on to today's episode. Sometimes I wonder what makes us so intrigued with these cases, why it's somewhat fascinating to hear about these real-life crimes happening to real-life people. And when I say fascinating, I don't mean exciting or something that makes us happy when we hear about them. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's the opposite, that it makes the majority of us feel sad. But it also makes us aware that we aren't invincible, that these things happen and they happen to everyday people just like you and just like me. And that's a scary thought. But if we learn something from these cases, and from the way that our justice system is set up, in my opinion, we will be much better off. I think that for those people who don't follow these cases, maybe it's because they feel invincible, or they feel that it doesn't affect them in any way, and that they have other things to worry about that maybe are more immediate in their lives. And that's fair. But the thing is, it can and it does affect every single one of us, whether you may know it or not. I want to tell you a little bit about my background. I'm from a family of law enforcement. My dad, my brother-in-law, and a bunch of my cousins are all law enforcement officers. I grew up trusting in our system and thinking that everything is on the up and up, and that as long as I obey all of the laws, I'll never have to deal with any kind of wrongful imprisonment or being harassed in any way by a higher power. And let me be clear, overall, I do think that we have a great justice system, and I do think that the majority of our law enforcement officers are brave and that they have the best intentions to serve their communities. But I also think that there's room for improvement, and that might be putting it mildly. There's room for a lot of improvement. When I got older is when I started to realize that our system isn't perfect. My childhood best friend's dad was a police officer in the town that I grew up in, and one day he held a gun up to his wife's head in front of his children. The police came to the house, but he was never arrested, and there could be a million reasons why that was, and to be honest, I was too young to fully understand what those reasons could have been, but the fact remains that he got away with it. Another friend of mine has a father who's in prison for a white-collar crime, and he's in prison for a very long time. I see her having all of these major life moments while her dad is stuck in a prison cell, hundreds of miles away, getting older and older. He made mistakes, that's not disputed. But is the price he's paying for those mistakes fair? Maybe, but maybe not. And then I started following court cases that I saw on court TV. OJ, Scott Peterson. And I realized that, wow, not only do people really kill people in cold blood, but sometimes the system works and sometimes it doesn't. Case in point, Scott Peterson is on death row and OJ got off scot-free. Free to go golfing and party with friends, and free to write a book about the details of the crime. I'm sorry, the details of the crime if he had done it. Right. Granted, we all know that OJ was later arrested on a different charge, but he still, technically, may have gotten away with Ron and Nicole's murder. So thus began my fascination with the justice system, and all the rights, all the wrongs, everything that goes with it. And when I started this podcast, I was absolutely floored to meet all of you guys and know that you feel pretty much the same way. So today, being that we're rapidly approaching the end of the year, I want to talk about 2016. I think we can all agree that it wasn't the greatest year, as far as losing Prince, David Bowie, and just recently, Alan Thicke. With everything going on in Aleppo, with the craziness of the 2016 U.S. election, and I think we can all agree, no matter what your politics are, the campaign season itself definitely had its lows. And with the attacks in Brussels and Orlando, and the list goes on. But there were highs and lows in the true crime court junkie world, too. So here are the ones that affected me the most this year. The first case I'm going to talk about is a sad case out of Canada that involves a senseless and incomprehensible murder. Earlier this year, a trial took place in Ontario that had me pretty much glued to my computer for updates. It unfortunately wasn't aired on TV, nor was it live streamed online anywhere, but it was a case that I was really passionate about, so I had to follow it by refreshing a live blog from a local publication every few minutes. I'm talking about the trial of Dellen Millard and Mark Smitch, two co-defendants who were being tried together. If you're unfamiliar with who these two men are, I'll fill you in. In May 2013, a 32-year-old husband and father named Tim Bosma said goodbye to his wife and left his home with two men who had come over to test drive his pickup truck that he had listed for sale online. Only the men, Millard and Smitch, had another motive: to kill. Once inside the truck and once they were away from Tim's house, Millard and Smitch shot and killed Tim in cold blood. They then put his body into an incinerator and hid his truck. A massive search party ensued, but it wasn't until a week later that Millard and Smitch were arrested. And after Tim's remains were found, what was left of him, both men were charged with his murder. The trial started in February, and a ton of heartbreaking details came to light, one of them being that Millard and Smitch had planned for more than a year to steal a truck, kill its owner, and incinerate the body. They had no idea who Tim Bosma was. They just knew that they wanted to kill someone. Thankfully, after 5 days of deliberating, the jury found Millard and Smitch guilty of first-degree murder. Tim's wife, Charlene, spoke to reporters after the trial had ended.
So, today has been a very long-awaited day for our families. For over 3 years, we have waited for justice for Tim. For 3 years, we have been in and out of this courthouse, forced to look at and breathe in the same space with the utter depths of depravity in our society. We have had to endure being near the two men that walked down my driveway on May 6, 2013, and took away the bright life in our lives that was Tim.
Okay.
It is their own unspeakable evil acts that have taken away their freedom. Will saying it is unfair. What is unfair is that now that this chapter is over, we have to truly begin building our lives.
Although the Tim Basma case is now closed, Millard and Smitch have another trial to go through early next year. They are both accused of murdering 23-year-old Laura Babcock, a woman from Toronto who had been romantically involved with Millard. Laura has been missing since the summer of 2012, and although her body has never been found, Millard and Smitch are going on trial for her murder. And if that wasn't enough, Millard has also been charged with murder in the death of his father, Wayne Millard. In November 2012, Wayne was found dead in his home, and although it was initially deemed a suicide, investigators say they have evidence that it was murder. A firm trial date for that one hasn't been set yet, but it's definitely going to be interesting to watch, especially because Millard has indicated that he may want to represent himself. The second case came about after I saw a documentary on it, and then it just so happened that there were major developments that occurred in the case afterwards. Back in September, I went to the screening of a documentary called Southwest of Salem at the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions. I live pretty close to there, so whenever they have an event like this, I always try to make sure to attend if I can. Southwest of Salem is a documentary about the San Antonio Four, and let me give you a little background on the case. The San Antonio Four are four women who were wrongfully convicted of aggravated sexual assault in the late 90s. Elizabeth Ramirez, Christy Mayhew, Cassandra Rivera, and Anna Vasquez were accused of sexually assaulting Elizabeth's two nieces. Elizabeth's nieces, who were 7 and 9 years old at the time, claimed that the four women had abused them while they had been staying over at their aunt's house. The niece's dad, Elizabeth's brother-in-law, who was married to her sister, had recently hit on Elizabeth before being rejected by her, and shortly afterwards, the sexual assault accusations had been made. All four ladies maintained their innocence. In 1997, Elizabeth went on trial, and a year later, the other three women were tried together. All four were found guilty. Years went by while the ladies served time in prison, and then the Innocence Project of Texas got involved. They discovered that the trial testimony from Dr. Nancy Kellogg had since been discredited, and in fact, Dr. Kellogg told the DA's office that her testimony at trial was now outdated and that she would not testify the same way today. At their trials, Dr. Kellogg had testified that the victims had markings on their hymens that were signs of sexual abuse, something that was later determined to be just normal variations of a female's anatomy. Then, one of Elizabeth's nieces recanted too, saying that her father had coached her on what to say. She said he had threatened her and told her that if she told the truth, she would be beaten. So with the new revelations, the district attorney agreed that the women should be released. So back in September, we went to the screening, and then we took part in a panel with the four women who talked about their experiences in prison, what it was like to be accused of something so horrendous, and their struggles to adjusting to life after prison. But they still had a huge burden hanging over them. They still hadn't been declared innocent, which, if you follow these wrongful conviction cases, that's often the most important thing to exonerees, the acknowledgement of their actual innocence. But then, about a month ago, in November, something major happened, and the Texas Court of Appeals finally declared the four women innocent.
Thank you.
My third case is one that is very near and dear to my heart. In August of this year, I started this podcast. And immediately after I put out my first episode about the Melissa Kalusinski case, I attended the evidentiary hearings that she had been granted. The hearings took place over 2 days in August and 1 day in September, and then 1 day for the reading of the judge's ruling. The answer that everybody following the case was wondering, would Melissa get a new trial? As you know, there were some pretty explosive things that came out during those hearings, including a set of x-rays that had potentially been altered before being given to the defense at Melissa's trial, and an accusation of perjury and straight-out lying from one of the state's main experts at trial. But Melissa's request for a new trial was ultimately denied, and so Melissa's attorney, Kathleen Zellner, is now filing an appeal. Needless to say, this was a major moment for me in 2016. I had become really invested in Melissa's case, despite my trying to stay neutral. I had been there in the courtroom, sitting right behind her family as they listened to the evidence. I had been there when the judge read his ruling, and I saw the looks on the faces of her family when he denied her petition. And I saw Melissa get whisked away immediately after that ruling was read, back into custody and back into prison. And I saw her mother break down into tears, unable to get up from her seat, even after everybody else had left the courtroom. As much as you try not to get so emotionally invested in these cases, sometimes it's just darn near impossible. I want to pause here for just a second to share a word from our sponsor, Lifeway Kefir. I've been getting a lot of great responses in our Facebook group about Lifeway Kefir, those who have been drinking it for quite a while, and those who just started after hearing about them in my last couple episodes. And all of the responses have been great. Some people drink them in the mornings, some people drink them as a snack, and some people even drink them as a dessert. The biggest draws being that they're both nutritious and tasty, all at the same time. Visit Lifeway Kefir for more information and for some great coupons. That's Lifeway, KEFIR.com. And now, back to the episode. We all have unsolved cases that really bother us, whether it's a case that's more high profile, like JonBenet Ramsey, or something a little more obscure. Maybe a crime that occurred close to home. This next one is one that isn't close to my home, but it's irked me ever since I heard about it. The disappearance of Heather Elvis. I think this case always struck me because I picture this young woman truly just beginning her adulthood when she just vanishes off the face of the earth. Heather was just 20 years old when she went missing from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, in the early morning hours of December 18th, 2013. Her roommate, who was out of town at the time, received a phone call from Heather, who told her that a married man that she had been having an affair with had called her and told her that he wanted to leave his wife for her. The roommate said that Heather was upset because Heather had broken off the affair with the guy, and Heather had just started moving on with her life when she received that phone call. The next day, Heather's car was found at Peachtree Boat Landing, not far from her apartment. Heather, though, was nowhere to be found. Sidney Moore, the married man, along with his wife, became suspects after investigators found threatening text messages from the wife to Heather. Phone records also showed that Sidney was likely the last person to speak with her the night that she went missing, leading many to wonder if the phone call he had made to her about leaving his wife was just a ruse to get her out of the apartment. The state charged Sidney with kidnapping Heather, apparently not having enough evidence to prove that an actual murder had occurred. Sidney went on trial for the charge in June of this year, but the jury couldn't reach a verdict, resulting in a mistrial. Reports say that 10 jurors believed that he was guilty and 2 believed that he was innocent. His retrial is scheduled for sometime next year. This next case, also from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, also had a major development this year. 17-year-old Brittany Drexel went missing from Myrtle Beach in April 2009 while on a spring break trip that she hid from her mother. Brittany was last seen on surveillance video leaving a hotel resort after visiting another friend. Her cell phone pinged off towers about an hour south later that night, but Brittany had seemingly vanished. Brittany's mom was understandably shocked when she learned that not only had her daughter snuck away to Myrtle Beach for spring break, but that she was now missing. I think that's every parent's worst nightmare. Years went by with speculation, theories, and accusations in the case running wild, but no real answers as to what had happened to Brittany. Until June of this year, investigators held a press conference with a startling update. They had info that Brittany was no longer alive.
What we've come to discover through the course of the investigation now is that Brittany Drexel did leave the Myrtle Beach area. We believe she traveled to this area around McClellanville and the North Charleston, South Georgetown area, and we believe she was killed after that.
Investigators offered a $25,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of those responsible. And then, in August, some more awful news came out. Police had a suspect, and the details of what they believe happened to Brittany were gruesome. A jailhouse informant had spoken to police and told them that he knew what happened to Brittany. The informant's name was Taquan Brown, and he's currently serving a 25-year sentence for voluntary manslaughter in a different case. Brown said he saw Brittany after her disappearance. He said that she was at a stash house in McClellanville, where Brittany's phone had last pinged. He said he witnessed several men sexually abuse Brittany at the house. He then says he saw Brittany run out and try to escape, but she was caught, pistol-whipped, and brought back inside. Brown said he then heard 2 gunshots and saw her body wrapped up and taken from the house. And if all of that information wasn't bad enough, several people have also apparently told police that Brittany's body was dumped in an alligator pond in McClellanville. So, if 2016 brought that tragic news about what happened to Brittany, we can only hope that 2017 will bring her justice. Earlier in the year, in February, an arrest was made in a case that I have been closely following. This next case is one that is so shocking and complex, I feel like everyone needs to look this up after you finish this episode. Teresa Severs, a well-respected holistic doctor from Bonita Springs, Florida, was found beaten to death in her home in June 2015. She had been on a family vacation in Connecticut with her husband and 2 daughters, but had flown home earlier than the rest of her family so she could keep appointments she had the following day. Teresa left the airport and arrived at her home by herself on the night of June 28th. But when she walked in, her attackers were waiting for her. Suspicion fell on her husband, Mark Severs, because let's be honest, naturally, that's the first person you think of in cases like this. And the suspicion only increased after her husband's childhood friend, along with another man, were arrested and charged in Teresa's murder. So, why would her husband's friend want her dead? Well, in February, we found out what the police theory was. Mark Severs was arrested and charged with Teresa's murder. His childhood friend had given him up to police. And it looked like Mark may have planned his wife's entire murder. There was another arrest this year, and another case that I have been keeping an eye on. 41-year-old Dan Markell, a law professor at Florida State University, was shot and killed while sitting in his car in his driveway in July 2014. He had just driven home from the gym and was still in his car talking on the phone when someone walked right up the driveway, right up to his window, and shot him in the head. He had just gone through a contentious divorce, and people immediately wondered if the divorce had something to do with his death. In June of this year, two alleged hitmen were indicted on first-degree murder charges after video surveillance showed the two men driving a rental car in the area where Dan had been killed on the day of the shooting. One of the men took a plea deal and told investigators that the murder had in fact been a hired hit. And who hired them? Police warrants showed that suspicion was on Dan's former in-laws, his ex-wife's family. Then, in October, another arrest was made, and this one was the link that everybody had been wondering about, the link between the two alleged hitmen and Dan's former in-laws. Catherine Magbanua was arrested and charged in Dan's murder, and she had reportedly been dating Dan's former brother-in-law during the time when Dan was murdered, and she knew both of the hitmen, too. One of them was her children's father. 2020 did a great episode on this case that I'll include a link to in the show notes. The trials for Catherine and the other hitman will hopefully be next year. This last case is a real doozy. Towards the end of August, I became aware of a couple that was missing from Anderson County, South Carolina. A 30-year-old woman named Kayla Brown and her boyfriend, 32-year-old Charles Carver. The case didn't get a lot of media attention at first. There were a few news reports about them, sure, and a web sleuth thread, but not much more than that at first. It was a bizarre case. Upon getting the missing persons report, police went to the couple's apartment to investigate. They found Kayla's car in the parking lot, but Charlie's was nowhere to be found. The two of them seemed to have just vanished into thin air. And then, weeks later, something very bizarre happened. Charlie's Facebook page started posting updates, and they didn't appear to be from Charlie. Someone created life events on Facebook, saying that Charlie and Kayla were expecting a daughter, and another one saying that they had bought a house, and yet another saying that they were getting married. And then Charlie's Facebook started posting weird memes. One of them said, "Sometimes late at night, I dig a hole in the backyard to keep the nosy neighbors guessing." And another post read, "It's never going to end. They are not coming home to their families." As terrifying as the messages were, it helped the case get more media attention, and pretty soon their story was going viral. But no one could have predicted what happened next. On November 3rd, Kayla was found alive in a big metal shipping container on a property in Woodruff, South Carolina. She had chains around her feet and neck, but she was alive. Police took 45-year-old Todd Kohlhepp into custody. He was a Spartanburg County real estate broker and licensed pilot, and Kayla had reportedly been doing some work for him. Police said they were on the property when they heard someone banging from the inside of the container. They opened it and found Kayla, but not Charlie. Kayla told police that she had witnessed Todd shoot and kill Charlie, and sure enough, they later found his body on the property. But that wasn't all. Todd was a serial killer. Two other bodies were discovered on the property, and they would later be identified as 26-year-old Megan Lee McCraw Coxie and her husband, 29-year-old Johnny Joe Coxie. The couple was from Spartanburg, and they had been missing since December 22, 2015. Todd also confessed to a 2003 cold case, the killing of four people who were found shot to death inside Superbike Motorsports, a motorcycle shop in Chesney, South Carolina. There is much more to this story, and I'm obviously just giving you a little recap here, but as it turns out, Todd was a very, very dangerous man. And who knows what will come out next. There were other cases that had big updates that occurred this year. Oscar Pistorius being sentenced to 6 years in prison, Burke Ramsey appearing on Dr. Phil, and more recently, the case of Sherry Papini, the Redding, California mom who went missing for 3 weeks and then was miraculously found at the side of the road on Thanksgiving Day. But I hope this episode gives you a little bit more insight on the different cases that I follow. Some of them make it into the podcast, while others do not. And now I want to know what your case obsessions from this year were. We'll be discussing these in my Court Junkie Facebook group, and I'd love it if you would join. Just go to courtjunkie.com/Facebook, and you can join right from there. To support this podcast, you can visit courtjunkie.com/support, and it will take you to my Patreon page, where you can donate as little as $1 a month and become a supporter. My Patreon supporters enjoy early access to my Court Junkie briefs, as well as ad-free versions of my regular episodes. A special thank you to Lifeway Kefir for sponsoring this podcast. To contact me, you can reach me on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod. You can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Or you can join our Facebook group and talk to not only me, but our wonderfully awesome community of Court Junkies. Thanks for listening. Until next time.